You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archived materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. Kian Sweeney was living the dream. The 33-year-old barman had relocated from Dublin to the Mediterranean island of Mallorca. Most locals knew him because if he wasn't pulling pints or shaking cocktails, he was out on the town, partying and socializing. He had quite the reputation as a ladies' man. Tourists, locals, colleagues. Kian had charmed them all. He had a VIP membership at Stargirl's Bar, a strip club in Puerto Portals, and was known to all the sex workers as a regular customer. Then he met Katie, a British native who lived and worked on the island as well. She swept him off his feet, and before long she moved into his apartment. Their apartment was small, but it was all they needed. Katie looked forward to their future together and thought the tall, dark, and handsome Kian was the perfect guy. On Saturday evening of July 10th, 2004, Kian kissed her goodbye and got into his Peugeot moped, heading off to start his shift at Karma Bar, overlooking Puerto Portals Marina. But everything was about to come crumbling down. He was working behind the bar and had just struck up a conversation with an Irish tourist when a man approached him. It was an Interpol detective who asked him to accompany him to the nearest police station. Kian was confused and wanted to know what was going on. With no explanation, the detective, supported by police, took Kian in custody. Kian protested and told his boss he would be back soon and that it was all a terrible misunderstanding. But it wasn't. Kian, or Martin Bernard Sweeney, was not who he said he was. He came from Dublin, yes. But Kian was not the jovial man about town who everyone in Mallorca got to know and love. On the contrary, he was a cold-blooded killer who had fled Ireland 3 years before. His name was Colin Whelan. Colin Whelan was 22 when he met 19-year-old Mary Goff at the Huntsman Inn. The pub was the local watering hole in Gormanstown, where Mary had been working as a barmaid for 2 years. It was only 2 miles away from the Goff family home where Mary lived with her mom and her brothers. Colin had a broken leg when he met Mary, an injury he sustained at an REM concert at Slane Castle. She felt sorry for him, and the two became good friends over the summer of 1993. Mary was a laid-back, quiet person, and those who knew her enjoyed her quick wit. The only girl in a family with 5 brothers, Mary was a straight shooter who did not waste time trying to keep up with appearances. If she was happy, she was happy. If she was cross, she was cross. Simple as that. Mary's dad, James Goff, passed away in 1989, and it was a devastating blow to her mother, Marie. Mary and Marie always had a good relationship, and after James passed away, they became inseparable. Mary was a pillar of strength for her mother and a ray of sunshine to her brothers. Her brothers always said that Mary was the sister their mom never had. Colin Whelan was the youngest of 5 children and was born on the 14th of July, 1971. He grew up in Gormanstown, not far from Mary's family home. With his broken leg, Colin spent a lot of time at the Huntsman Inn and got to know the barmaid rather well. It took him about 6 months to ask her out, and they started seeing each other casually. Colin was handsome and ambitious, he had a degree and a stable job in IT, and Mary loved spending time with him. Her family could see how happy she was and took Colin in as one of their own. In 1995, they broke up for a short while, but eventually got back together again. The breakup came out of the blue for Mary, and she could not understand how Colin could suddenly be so cold-hearted. She was inconsolable, and her mother decided to reach out to Colin to ask him what went wrong. If he could only give Mary a reason, perhaps she could get closure and move on. Colin was not overly concerned that he had broken Mary's heart and told her mom that if Mary was saddened by the breakup, it wasn't his fault that she felt like that. This was the first time Marie saw a heartless side of the young man she had become to love like a son. Mary dusted herself off and focused on her future. She worked as a secretary in the production house that created the film Rob Roy. It was a great fit. Mary was organized and always paid attention to detail. When her contract ran out, the production company offered Mary a position in Scotland, but she turned it down. Although she didn't admit it to her family and friends, everyone suspected that she was still burning a torch for Colin Whelan, hoping they would be able to rekindle their relationship. And she wasn't wrong. Colin resurfaced, and Mary saw him a couple of times. After 6 months apart, they decided to give their relationship another go. This time, the relationship seemed more serious, and everyone knew it was a matter of time before Colin popped the big question. In August of 1997, Colin bought his grandfather's house on 49 Clonard Street, Balbriggan, on the outskirts of Dublin. They moved in together, and things were lining up for their future. Colin worked at a bank, Irish Permanent, on St. Stephen's Green in Dublin, as an IT programmer. Mary worked at a solicitor's office in Sword. Just when it looked like life couldn't get any better for the young couple, tragedy struck. One night, Colin, who had had a couple of drinks at the Huntsman Inn, was driving home when he collided with his neighbor's car. In her own vehicle following behind, Mary saw Colin's vehicle smashing into the Murphy's car, killing 62-year-old Elizabeth in the passenger seat. Colin was charged with dangerous driving, causing death, but he was found not guilty due to a lack of evidence. He received a fine, and his license was suspended to 6 months, but that was all. In October 1998, Colin and Mary got engaged in Fuerteventura, and Mary was over the moon. Although she was ready to tie the knot as soon as possible, they decided to wait for 2 years. They got married on the 9th of September, 2000, a day that Mary's family and friends would never forget. Mary was reluctant and tearful on that day. After the ceremony, standing beside her new husband, she burst out into tears and ran back into the church. Her mom and bridesmaids followed, but Marie recalled Colin didn't seem concerned about her at all. Weddings can be emotional, and everyone assumed Mary was overcome because her father was not there to walk her down the aisle. But there was something else brewing behind appearances. The couple went to Singapore and Thailand on their honeymoon, and when they returned, they moved back into their Balbriggan home, freshly renovated for the new chapter in their lives. It was then that Mary's mom noticed a difference in her. Mary was distant, did not seem as independent as she was before. Previously, Marie stayed over at Mary and Colin's, but once they were married, they never invited her again. Mary kept promising they'd meet for lunch, but something always came up. If they did manage to get together, Colin was always present. What was also concerning was that Mary's appearance became increasingly shabby. She didn't seem to go through any trouble. Before she was married, she loved going shopping with her mom. But when she came back from her honeymoon, she never wanted to go anywhere. Marie sensed tension between the newlyweds and was worried because she could see her daughter was unhappy. She hoped it was only temporary and had faith that Mary and Colin would work things out. At the beginning of 2001, they went to Drogheda to meet with a homeopath, seeing as Mary wanted to live a healthier lifestyle. She was excited about an upcoming detox program. 27-year-old Mary did not live to see her 28th birthday. Shortly after midnight on the 1st of March, Colin called emergency services in a panic. "Hi, I need an ambulance. My wife is after falling down the stairs." He said that she was badly injured. The operator asked if his wife was conscious, and he replied that he didn't think so. While on the line, the operator talked him through performing CPR on his injured wife. But Mary was unresponsive. The ambulance arrived at 12:30 and found Mary wrapped in a duvet at the bottom of the stairs. Colin had placed a towel under her head to prop her up. Her body was cold, and their efforts to revive her were unsuccessful. Mary was pronounced dead on arrival at Beaumont Hospital in Dublin. Her family had been notified and arrived at the hospital shortly after. The case landed on the desk of Sergeant Pat Mary. Mary and his team secured the scene at the Whelan home as a precaution. At this point, it all seemed like a tragic accident, but some things didn't quite add up. A nurse, seeing a distraught Colin, went over to sympathize with him. She noticed strange scratch marks on his chest and asked what had happened. He seemed to notice it for the first time and tried to downplay it, saying that Mary must have flailed. This was inconsistent with his version of events, that Mary was unconscious and only took shallow breaths while lying at the bottom of the stairs. The ambulance workers agreed that Mary had probably died earlier than what Colin said. If she had just fallen down the stairs, and they arrived within 15 minutes, she would not have been cold to the touch, and they may even have been able to save her life. The position Mary's body was in when they arrived was also puzzling. For someone who had fallen down a flight of stairs, her limbs were strangely intact. Her body laid straight like she was sleeping. Her head was at an awkward angle. It was evident to them that the husband never performed CPR. Also, Mary had blood on her face, coming from her nose. If Colin had tried to give her mouth to mouth, he should have had blood on his hands or face as well, but he didn't. When paramedics tried to save Mary, Colin looked on nervously. His only question was, "Is she dead?" Mary's mom, Marie, recalled Colin's strange behavior when she arrived at Beaumont Hospital. She said, "I walked up to Colin and he was sitting with his head in his hands, and I said, 'How's Mary?' He just said she was dead, just like that. I couldn't get over it. I'll never forget the way he answered me. He was just sitting there. I was looking at everyone else, roaring and crying. I didn't know what to think." Mary's sudden death was flagged with the pathologist who performed an autopsy. Hemorrhaging in the eyes, swollen tongue, and a mark on her neck led pathologists to conclude that the cause of death was asphyxiation. She had been strangled to death. Strangely, though, there was no bruising around the neck, as one would expect in a case of strangulation, only a ligature mark on the left side. There were also no injuries that would have been consistent with falling down the stairs, such as head injuries or broken bones. On her buttocks were carpet burns, consistent with someone being dragged. The pathologist informed Pat Mary that this was no accident. It was a homicide. Suspicion immediately fell on her grieving husband, an emotionless widower who could not even find it in himself to embrace Mary's mom when she learned she had lost her only daughter. In fact, the Goff family found his behavior in the aftermath of Mary's death to be very odd. When he talked about funeral arrangements, he referred to Mary as the body. He expressed no sympathy to any of her family members and even went so far as to say he wished she wasn't home when she fell. It would have been easier if he had come home and discovered her. Then the police wouldn't have so many questions. The morning after Mary's death, Colin Whelan went to Balbriggan Garda Station to make a formal statement. Investigators put him at ease and said it was only a formality. In the statement, Whelan stuck to his story about Mary falling down the stairs. He stated that other than Mary, he was the only person in the house at the time. This part of the statement would come back to haunt him. Investigators informed Mary's mother on the Friday morning that evidence proved Mary did not die from falling down the stairs, but that she was strangled. It didn't come as a tremendous shock, as Marie had suspected Colin had something to do with her daughter's death. However, Gardai asked Marie not to inform the Whelan family about the homicide investigation. Marie agreed, but called her own family together to break the tragic news to them. A week after Mary's murder, her family buried her. The service took place in the same church where she exchanged vows with her suspected killer 6 months before. Whelan attended the funeral with the support of his family. At this point, his family had not been told that Mary was murdered. They were also in shock, having lost their daughter and sister-in-law. At the funeral, Colin caused a scene, feigning an emotional outburst which upset the mourners at the funeral. Mary's family managed to gracefully ignore the man who had become a stranger to them overnight. To them, it was clear that his outpour was an act, an attempt to gain sympathy. Police asked him to describe events of the evening before the incident. Colin Whelan told investigators that he and Mary were watching TV when Mary said she was going upstairs to take a shower, and moments later, just about midnight, he heard thump, thump, thump. When he ran to see what was going on, he found her at the bottom of the stairs, unconscious. He saw all the blood and went upstairs to fetch a towel. Investigators broke the news to the Goff family. Mary's death was no accident. She was murdered. They were dumbfounded. Colin could be cold and indifferent, but no one believed he would ever harm Mary. A forensic search of the home on Clonard Street took place. There were bloodstains in multiple locations, starting in the upstairs bedroom, then suggesting movement to the landing. There must have been an assault. On the wallpaper in the main bedroom was blood mist, a fine blood splatter pattern that typically occurs when someone is strangled. The vessels and the nose burst, causing the victim to spray blood as they exhale. The home phone that Colin used to call emergency services was clean. If Colin was going to and fro, from Mary to the telephone, performing CPR, traces of Mary's blood or mucus would have been present. Forensic testing showed that there was nothing. It painted a sinister picture of Colin acting while he was talking to the operator. He did absolutely nothing to help his wife, most likely because he knew she was no longer alive. The forensic team also checked the log of the house alarm. No windows or doors opened after the couple arrived back home at 9:45 p.m. There was no sign of a break-in, and it was clear that no third party could have entered the house unbeknownst to Colin and Mary. Searching the Whelan home, the guard I discovered an interesting document. 3 months before their wedding, in June 2000, Whelan doubled the life insurance on himself and his fiancée. He changed this shortly after the first policy was approved. The terms stipulate that if Mary were to die within the first 10 years of their marriage, Colin stood to inherit 400,000 Irish pounds. If something happened to Colin, Mary would receive a payout of the same amount. What was strange was that the policy had an expiry date. It would only pay if one of them died within 10 years. Guard I looked at Whelan's work computer and were surprised to find that his hard drive had been wiped. Computer forensic science was still in its infancy. Investigators could access the bank's main hard drive, double proxy servers, and found backups giving them all the information they needed. With the life insurance policy, he searched the internet using terms like asphyxiation, causes death within seconds, locking windpipe, death by strangulation, and lack of oxygen effects. These searches began in the weeks leading up to their wedding. So while Mary was going for her dress fittings and deciding which flowers to choose, her fiancé was making plans of his own. He made no less than 22 searches for ways to kill his wife. 4 months into his marriage, he was very active in online chat rooms, portraying himself as a widowed man, going by the screen name Celtic Tackler. This is how he described himself. "Hi, my name is Colin. I'm a true red-blooded Irish male, 29 years young, into music scene, good food and wine, etc. Like to enjoy the beauty of nature as often as possible. Hope to chat to either sex, of any age, race, religion, or creed. So go on, drop me a line. You may enjoy the Celtic experience." It may sound innocent enough, but before long, he met a woman who lived in Wales, Helen Shepherd. He told the divorced mother of two that his wife had died in a motor vehicle accident 7 years before. A series of sweet and flirtatious emails and messages followed, with the woman not knowing that he was a married man. He sent a photo of himself, well, a picture of his face photoshopped onto the body of a model. They planned a meetup in March. Whelan told his online girlfriend he was excited about a large inheritance coming his way. For his first Valentine's Day as a married man, Colin went through a lot of effort, but not for his wife, Mary. No, he sent flowers and a card to his online girlfriend in Wales. He wrote a 60-line poem, pouring out his romantic feelings towards her. And it worked. When she read his poem, Helen was convinced that Colin was the guy for her, and she told him that she was eager to meet him. Meanwhile, Colin the husband's plan was growing more sinister by the day. He researched the murder method used by an American serial killer, Henry Lewis Wallace, active in the early 1990s. Wallace used a towel to cover a piece of cord when he strangled his victims. This way, there wasn't a dark mark where the cord wrapped around the victim's neck. He also kept his victims' bodies warm, so forensic investigators would have trouble determining the exact time of death. Police combed through the Whelan home, looking for the cord or rope used to strangle Mary. Various items were tested, but when they got to Colin's dressing gown belt, everything became clear. The middle section had been stretched, and testing showed Mary's blood in the fibers. When police found the belt, it was in place, on the dressing gown. So, as Colin watched paramedics scramble to save his wife, he stood with the murder weapon tied around his waist. In building the case against Whelan, investigators went to Wales to visit his online girlfriend, Helen Shepherd. Helen welcomed them inside and confirmed that she knew Colin Whelan. In fact, his photograph was on her fridge. But she said she hadn't heard from him for a couple of days. Pat Mary told her that his wife was dead. She wasn't surprised. She knew his wife died in a car crash a long time before. The investigator informed her that Colin's wife had only died recently and that Colin was suspected of killing her. Helen was shocked and she physically collapsed. Once she calmed down, Helen said she would do anything she could to help. She had kept printouts of all their correspondence, an astonishing testament of their love affair. It was also evident that she had no knowledge that Colin was married to Mary, and definitely not of the plot to murder his wife. Whelan was arrested and charged with murder. He did not admit to anything. When police showed him all the evidence, he stubbornly answered, "No comment," to everything. The trial date was set for October 2003, 2 years later. Jimmy Brassel, his brother-in-law, paid half of his bail, and Colin paid the rest. He was released on the very same day. The accused wife killer was allowed to live at home, but Permanent Bank did not want him back. He moved in with his parents and rented out the house on Clonard Street, which gave him an income. He had to surrender his passport and report to police daily. He diligently signed in at Balbriggan Garda Station every day for a year. For the most part, he drove around town in Mary's car, and to his family, he seemed depressed from time to time. Then, in May 2002, his family reported him missing. A quick review of Balbriggan Garda Station paperwork confirmed that he had signed in the day before. Where was he? Mary's car was not at his house, and no one had seen him in 2 days. The Garda sent out an alert. And before long, Mary's Peugeot 203 was found abandoned at Hoth Head, a scenic spot popular with hikers. The car was parked in a lot near a cliff's edge. On the passenger seat, they found the car keys and an empty bottle of gin. Did Whelan drink the entire bottle and jump over the cliff into the Atlantic? A comprehensive land and sea search did not yield a body. This was a formality because no one in law enforcement believed Colin Whelan had taken his own life. Still, they needed to exclude the possibility that he had done so. Pat Mary smelled a rat from the start. The car was neatly parked in a parking bay. It did not look like the scene where someone, at the end of his tether, had come to end things. Because there was no sign of Whelan, and he was a murder suspect with an upcoming trial, the Garda launched a large-scale manhunt. Whelan's photo was distributed to all media channels and widely publicized. For over a year, there was no sign of Whelan anywhere in Ireland. Police kept the story in the news as much as possible, and eventually, it paid off. One night, a woman reading the newspaper saw Colin's photo and her blood ran cold. She had recently been on holiday in Mallorca with her husband when they met an Irish bartender in Puerto Portals. The man introduced himself as Cian Sweeney, and they got talking about rugby. After a pleasant conversation, the couple agreed to send him a rugby jersey once they were back home and asked for his address. He gave them the pub's business card and wrote his email address on the back. But seeing wanted murderer Colin Whelan's picture, the woman realized that the man she spoke to was not who he said he was. She contacted the police and told them about meeting Whelan in Mallorca. Pat Mary studied the handwriting on the card and compared it with Whelan's handwritten statement he had on file. Even to the naked eye, it was an exact match. In Mallorca, 33-year-old Cian Sweeney was loved by everyone who met him. He was working in a bar, had a girlfriend, and enjoyed his life. The bar owner where he worked was blown away when he learned about Cian, or rather Colin's past. He recalled what Colin told him about his life in Ireland. All he said was his parents were dead, and he didn't have any family. As an employee, he didn't give us any problems. He did his job well, and he'd go for a few beers in the evenings when he clocked off. It's come as a major shock to us to learn he was wanted for the murder of his wife. The amiable bartender's number was up. Garda contacted police in Mallorca and informed them about the situation. The fugitive was arrested within the hour. He insisted they had the wrong person, that he did not know anything about Colin Whelan and his murdered wife. However, fingerprints confirmed that he was the man wanted by Irish police. He was kept in Palma Prison while waiting to be extradited. Whelan explained to Pat Mary how he made his way to Spain. To get a passport, he assumed the identity of his childhood neighbor, Martin Bernard Sweeney. Colin and Martin were never friends, but knew each other well enough. Martin lived with his parents, and Colin knew he didn't have a passport. Colin knew enough about him to impersonate him. They were, after all, two Gormanstown's lads of the same age and somewhat similar appearance. Somehow, Colin managed to get his hands on Sweeney's birth certificate, and being of the same age, passed himself off as Martin when he applied for a passport. Colin received the passport with his photograph and Martin's name. He drove around a lot, looking for the best location to stage his suicide. He chose Hoathhead because there were no CCTV cameras. On the morning he disappeared, he abandoned Mary's car, then took the train going north to Belfast, from where he flew to London, using the legally obtained passport. From London, he traveled to Barcelona, from where he caught a boat to Mallorca. He was granted a Spanish national identity card and worked at the Karma Bar in the resort town of Puerto Portals. He told people his name was Kean because it was closer to his real name, Colin. If people asked where he was from, he'd simply say Dublin, and never gave too many details. It was a lucky break that they caught him when they did, because Kean had planned to travel to Singapore the next week. After a short stay in Madrid prison, he was extradited back to Ireland to stand trial for the murder of his wife. His brother-in-law, Jimmy Brassel, who had paid more than £9,000 for his bail in 2003, was ordered to pay €1,000 because Whelan breached bail conditions. Jimmy's solicitor said that he was as surprised as anybody that Colin disappeared. Jimmy organized a search looking for Colin's remains when his car was found, but the judge upheld the fine, saying that by bailing out a murder suspect, he accepted the responsibility to ensure Whelan did not become a fugitive. But he did. So all up, Jimmy lost over $10,000 thanks to Colin Whelan. At Jimmy's hearing, Whelan didn't even make eye contact, let alone apologize or take any responsibility. On April 11, 2005, Colin Whelan's trial began at the Central Criminal Court in Dublin. Much to everyone's surprise, he pleaded guilty. When his family heard him admit guilt, they were shocked. Mary's family did not expect that either. They thought that Colin would try to get away with it again. The true story of what happened inside Colin and Mary's home on February 28, 2001 was revealed. Colin had planned to end his wife's life methodically. He wanted her out of the way before he met his online girlfriend. On that Wednesday afternoon, Whelan was at work like any other day. He clocked in at work at 8 a.m. At lunchtime, he went out and bought a gift for Mary. It was a small figurine, the second one in the pair, of which they received the first as a wedding gift. When he returned to the office, he called his online girlfriend and happily discussed their plans to meet up. She would come to Ireland and stay at his house for a couple of days. He had done his research about the impending murder and was confident that his chosen killing method would work. To dot the I's and cross the T's, he searched the term loss of consciousness one last time on his work computer. This was at 2:24 p.m. 10 hours later, Mary was dead. He called Mary to say he would be leaving soon and then took the train home. While Mary prepared their dinner, Colin went to the gym. When he returned at 7 p.m., they had their meal together. And then Colin drove Mary to Drogheda, where she had a 9:15 p.m. appointment with a homeopath to discuss blood test results. The homeopath did not notice anything strange and thought Colin was his usual self. Back home, Mary excitedly read through the information about her upcoming detox before going upstairs to change into her pajamas. Meanwhile, her calculating husband was preparing to set his dark plan into motion. Without warning, Mary's husband of less than a year entered the bedroom, walked up to her, placed a towel wrapped around the belt from his dressing gown, around her neck, and strangled her. Mary fought and struggled to get out of his firm grip. She scratched his chest, drawing blood, and he let go. Desperate to escape the situation, Mary ran out of the bedroom, but Colin quickly caught up with her and grabbed her arm with such force that he tore her pajama shirt sleeve. Angered and determined to finish what he had started, Colin dragged his wife back to the bedroom by her long brown hair and shoved her onto their bed. Mary kicked him, trying her best to fend him off. But Colin didn't budge. He took the yellow towel again and hooked it back around her neck. Mary lost consciousness, and before long, she was dead. Colin did not stop to consider what he had just done. Instead, he jumped into action to complete the second part of his plan, posing her body to make it look like there had been an accident. He dragged his wife's body down the stairs, head first, her back bruised as her lifeless body thumped down step by step. In a statement read in court by the defense attorney, Hugh Harnett, Whelan admitted that he was a coward. He read a statement in court saying that he accepted full responsibility for Mary's death, and a quote from Whelan states, "I know these words will ring hollow for Mary's family. I will live with this regret and sorrow for the rest of my life. There are no words to explain my act." To Mary's mother, Marie, he said, "I apologize for the protracted delay today, and I apologize for taking your daughter, friend, and soulmate so unnecessarily." Whelan said that he was sorry for taking Mary away from her family. Whelan was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. Mr. Justice Carney said that this crime was a case of the most calculated and callous killing he had ever witnessed. Mary's family felt deeply betrayed. Not only did they lose their daughter and sister, but they also lost Colin, who was one of them, a brother and a son. Mary's brother David made a victim impact statement. He looked at Colin when he said that the Goff family would never, ever, ever forgive him, because he took a piece of each of them when he ended Mary's life. Marie Goff struggled to come to terms with the fact that Colin was the one who took her daughter's life. She said that Mary's only crime was loving Colin Whelan too much. It was her one true mistake in life. The fact that Colin had never asked for their forgiveness or said sorry in person proved to Marie how heartless her daughter's husband was. She said, "I wouldn't have minded for him to apologize to my face. He'll get out in so many years for good behavior. His family can visit him, bring him little gifts, talk to him, and put their arms around him and give him a hug. But I haven't got that. I stand in a graveyard, and that's it." Why did he do it? If life in Mallorca was how he wanted to live, why marry Mary? Marie Goff doubts he ever really loved Mary, and that he married her to kill her and cash in on the life insurance payout. It wasn't a crime of passion, but a crime of greed. And he never received the money anyway, so what, one may ask, was the point of it all? A precious life lost? All for nothing. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcast or wherever you're listening right now. And while you're waiting for our next episode, why not listen to one of our podcasting friends?
My name is Bernadette, the host of Murderific True Crime Podcast. Murder plus horrific equals murderific. I cover some cases from the state of Maine in the United States and all over the world. Mass murders, domestic abuse, unsolved cases, serial killers, and mostly lesser known subjects. We don't shy away from the details, but we do that with all respect. This isn't entertainment. These are real people's lives, and I'm here to tell their story. Join me for my Season 5 reboot, and together we will be executing podcasts one crime at a time.
This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.